Hello, I'm Sean Lay. Thanks for downloading the BBC's World Tonight podcast from Friday the 22nd of November. The former Prime Minister Gordon Brown says Parliament is moving too quickly on assisted dying. Ahead of next week's key debate, he argues for an inquiry into palliative care instead. The Home Secretary Yvette Cooper says it's not a matter for her whether or not the UK would honour the International Criminal Court's warrant and arrest Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. So who would decide? An American mother with autistic children and a leading British researcher on what we still don't know about a condition which is being diagnosed in more and more children. How significant a force is mixed martial arts in the coalition that has propelled Donald Trump to the White House, and what might it get out of the new administration? And we hear the mellifluous tone of Scotland's oldest cello played in Aberdeen on Friday night for the first time in more than 200 years. The former Prime Minister Gordon Brown has joined the Health Secretary Wes Streeting in opposing the assisted dying bill, which MPs will debate a week from now. He becomes the first former Prime Minister to intervene in the current debate. In an article published on The Guardian's website this afternoon, he gives a moving account of the final hours of his baby daughter, Jennifer. She lived for 11 days before dying of the effects of a brain hemorrhage as Gordon Brown and his wife, Sarah, held her in their arms. He writes, "Those days we spent with her remain among the most precious days of my and Sarah's lives." Mr Brown writes of the importance of end-of-life care, arguing that MPs would do better to address what he calls the biggest postcode lottery of all, the patchy availability of palliative care. Here's an extract of his article, voiced by one of our producers.
Britain usually moves too slowly on those matters where it should move fast. But sometimes, as now, it can move too fast on an issue where it should go slower, listen and learn. And with the NHS still at its lowest ebb, this is not the right time to make such a profound decision. Instead, we need to show we can do better at assisted living before deciding whether to legislate on ways to die.
The MP promoting the Terminally Ill Adults End of Life Bill, Labour's Kim Leadbeater, was quick to challenge Mr Brown's argument that investment in palliative care should come first, pointing out her bill includes a requirement for ministers to report to Parliament on what palliative care is available and how good it is. Perhaps conscious that Gordon Brown remains an influential voice in the party, she added, "We need to do both." Regular listeners to this programme might recall when this latest round of the debate on assisted dying began over the summer, we brought together two peers with strong views on the arguments. Baroness Elora Finlay is a crossbench peer in the House of Lords, and she's Professor of Palliative Medicine at Cardiff University. Lord Charlie Faulkner is the former Lord Chancellor and Secretary of State for Justice, who served under Tony Blair, where he was a cabinet colleague of Gordon Brown, and who's campaigned for a change in the law on assisted dying for many years. He put forward a bill of his own, but withdrew it in favour of Kim Leadbeater's bill. Welcome to you both. Baroness Finlay, first of all, what do you make of his argument about the priority he thinks should be given to palliative care in this debate?
He's absolutely right. We hear stories of people whose care was inadequate, and we have to do something about it. But this bill is not going to improve palliative care at all, quite the reverse. We know from other countries that actually palliative care developments don't happen as fast once you change the law, because you divert resources and people away from focusing on what the needs are of those who are terminally ill. And we know in this country, we've got an NHS on its knees. We've got a fragmented palliative care service, and we need to get those addressed and get them right, not set them back even further.
Clearly, the case of Jennifer Brown is not directly related to this, but he is talking there about the importance of the quality of care we provide at end of life. Just he how is correct absolutely. Is he in saying, though, that it is the biggest postcode lottery of all?
It is a huge postcode lottery. And this bill is proposing that you'd have 100% funding of an NHS death service in effect. And yet we know only a third of the funding of hospices comes from the NHS at the moment. And we know that
palliative care is about more than just hospices, though, isn't it?
Of course it is. It's about much more. But we know that it's developed better in areas that have already got reasonable services. And we have a very patchy provision around the country. And we don't have services across the 24 hours across 7 days, and yet disease does not respect the clock or the calendar. People need to have services that are 7 days available.
Lord Faulkner, you can understand why people might be somewhat sceptical about the ability of government to legislate into existence a system when it's struggling to adequately fund and maintain the system it has already.
No, I think it is possible to legislate in a legal situation where people can be assisted in the last weeks or months of their life when they're suffering and they want to bring that suffering to an end. Ilora Finlay, Gordon Brown and I all agree that everything is possible should be done to increase palliative care. But it's a totally false dichotomy to say it's either helping people in those last few weeks or months to end their suffering and supporting palliative care. The Commons Select Committee on Health in the last 12 months did a very important report which suggested that those countries that introduce assisted dying legislation for the terminally ill tend to improve their palliative care because there is a focus on assisted dying. And one of the things about this bill that Kim Ledbetter is proposing is that there will be regular reviews by the Secretary of State on palliative care. This will improve palliative care, but I don't think the people who suffer should wait.
Ilora Finlay, just before you answer that point, can I just ask you this? The minister responsible for palliative care, Stephen Kinnock, has said he believes it is possible to do both.
He has responsibility for social care as well. And I really do think that has to be addressed. Can I just point out, this bill doesn't mention suffering anywhere in it at all. And if you talk about palliative care being available, there's been a fourfold less improvement in countries in Europe that went down this road and a sixfold less improvement in the US states that have gone down this road.
You mean as compared to countries or states that did the opposite?
Exactly. When you change the law, you divert resources across there. In New South Wales, the budget actually in Australia was cut by $249 million from the palliative care budget a year after legalisation. So it's a touching faith to say that things would improve, but the evidence is that it doesn't improve. The law has to apply to everyone in the country. And to improve the care for everyone in the country, we need to really address palliative care urgently across the piece.
Charlie Faulkner, do you think Gordon Brown's argument could be influential with some MPs who perhaps have yet to make up their mind, given the status he has within your party?
I'm sure people will give Gordon the fairest possible hearing. And I also think that he is an influential person within the Labour Party. But there are a lot of voices engaged in this debate. For example, of the 15 cabinet ministers in the Labour cabinet at the moment, 9 have come out in favour and 6 have come out against. But it's not a question of numbers. My experience of talking to members of parliament at the moment is they are weighing these factors very, very seriously. And I think the key thing that it's boiling down to is this. I think most people think people should have assistance when they're suffering in a terminal illness, but are the safeguards enough? And that is something, if the bill is given a second reading, that will be very seriously scrutinised when the bill goes through the Commons and the Lords. And the right course, and this is my sense of where the Commons is going at the moment, they're going where the public is, which is a majority favour a change in the law, but they want to see good safeguards.
And that is presumably where the devil is in the detail, Lady Finlay, in terms of your argument, but also presumably in terms of an area where some of the doubters could potentially be reassured, because it isn't necessarily the case, is it, that this legislation as presented is the final form?
Well, the devil certainly is in the detail. I find it incredible that we're seeing a bill which hasn't changed greatly from the one that was presented 10 years ago. So I really don't see improvements coming in. The term terminally ill is incredibly vague. The way it's defined in the legislation, it leaves
huge amounts. But that's for politicians to sort out, isn't it? That's what Parliament is for.
I think it won't get sorted out in the process in the Commons, because you'd actually have to rewrite this bill in its entirety to begin to make proper safeguards. These are just vague qualifying conditions. And I'm afraid they haven't learned from the experience in other countries adequately. If you had to, if you say, look, you've got two doctors behind closed doors in secret making a decision, people are horrified. Yet that is actually what the bill allows.
Baroness Allure, and then, Laura Finlay, I'm sorry to interrupt you. Lord Charlie Faulkner, thank you both very much. I hope we will have the opportunity to talk to you both again at some point in the very near future. We have, of course, the debate coming up next Friday in the House of Commons. And if you're listening to us before next week's vote, please keep sending your comments and experiences on assisted dying. We'll aim to share as many as we can on air to help to inform this debate, which, of course, is not just a debate for Parliament. It's a debate for each and every one of us as well. You can email world.tonight@bbc.co.uk or use WhatsApp. Number is 03700 100444, 03700 100444. Coming up later in the programme.
The sound in this room is so loud in here. It is so loud. It's always loud when he comes here, but yes. Now that he's won, now that he's the president again, yes. Oh my God.
The president-elect and the men in shorts by the high-octane world of mixed martial arts cheered for Donald Trump and help send him to the White House. But before we talk about Donald Trump, let's talk about another subject that's very much in the news at the moment, and that's the arrest warrant which was issued yesterday against the Prime Minister of Israel, Benjamin Netanyahu, his former defence secretary and the leader of Hamas. The Home Secretary, Yvette Cooper, was asked this morning whether the UK would, if given the opportunity, execute the arrest warrant against Benjamin Netanyahu. Yesterday, the International Criminal Court issued warrants which member countries, including the UK, would be expected to serve against any of those men, if, of course, any of them are on that country's territory. Since the UK is an ally of Israel and Mr. Netanyahu is not an infrequent visitor, the question is not just an academic one. Ms. Cooper stressed the ICC's independence, adding, "That's not a matter for me as Home Secretary." By this afternoon, however, the official government line appeared to have hardened. Asked whether Mr. Netanyahu faces arrest if he comes to the UK, the Prime Minister's official spokesman said he couldn't comment on hypotheticals, but the UK will always comply with its legal obligations as set out by domestic law and indeed international law. The BBC's legal affairs correspondent Dominic Casciani has been telling me what could happen.
It's a legal process, not a political one. It's set out very, very clearly in legislation. So at a high level, there's very little room for politicians to get involved. Quite simply, once the court has issued an arrest warrant, its officials send the request to each member state. And the UK's legislation over its relationship with the ICC says that the Secretary of State receives the request and then transmits the request to the appropriate judicial officer. That's the legalese for a judge. And if they are then satisfied that basically meets the standards, then in the words of the legislation, he shall endorse the warrant for execution in the UK. And that means that the ICC warrant then becomes a live document, no different to any other arrest warrant for a burglar from Northampton or anywhere else. And then it'll have to be actually acted on by a police force. So that's the first stage, Sean. Now, once it's acted upon, assuming, let's say, the Metropolitan Police could arrest Benjamin Netanyahu, and there's a lot of hypotheticals here, and they wouldn't be able to do that by going into, for instance, the Israeli embassy, because that's covered by diplomatic immunity. Assuming they did arrest him, he would then have to be brought back before the court, and the court would then have to be satisfied that the warrant is correct and that the person brought before the court is the person named on the warrant, and then would basically make what's called a delivery order. And that's effectively the legalese for an extradition to the International Criminal Court. So that's a pretty straightforward thing.
Is there any precedent for this?
Not quite, but I think the closest example for people with long memories is the arrest of General Pinochet in 1998. People may recall that he was visiting London at the time and there was an arrest warrant out for him for alleged crimes against humanity, those kind of things, in Chile. He was arrested. Now, he was a private citizen at the time, But the whole thing dragged on through the courts because of various issues, including diplomatic immunity and whether or not he could be fairly arrested, given that he had been a former head of state. And so you can imagine the kind of arguments which could be made in this hypothetical situation. I think one of the other things that's quite interesting about this is you've got to read in between the lines about where this particular government is. And the Attorney General, Lord Richard Hermer, who's a very distinguished senior lawyer, he very, very clearly said to me and other reporters a few weeks ago when we spoke to him that he would deal with an arrest warrant for Mr. Netanyahu and others like any other. He'd deal with it as a point of law, as a legal issue, fearlessly, without any kind of consideration of the politics.
That's Dominic Casciani, the BBC's legal affairs correspondent. Well, the former Conservative Cabinet Minister Teresa Villa's qualified for the bar and is herself a former law lecturer. She's also been a member of Conservative Friends of Israel for over 2 decades. Teresa Villa, thanks very much for being with us on The World Tonight. What do you make of the government's announcement, if I can put it like that, its emphasis on respecting international law, respecting the independence of the ICC, and making clear that it will honour its international commitments?
I feel that the UK government has got it profoundly wrong in that they're seemingly prepared to sit back and see a visiting prime minister potentially arrested. It is, the ICC doesn't have jurisdiction in this case because Israel is not a signatory to the ICC. And the previous government had quite rightly submitted an objection challenging these arrest warrants as wrong and unjustified. It is hugely to be regretted that the incoming Labour government decided to withdraw that objection. In the light of these latest developments, I think what they need to do now is revive that objection, fight this arrest warrant in the ICC, and if necessary, I think they should be prepared to consider withdrawal from the ICC if there is no other alternative. Israel is our ally. It's fighting for its survival. It's fighting a genocidal terrorist organisation, and we should be supporting it, not be prepared to see arrest warrants issued for its prime minister or former defence minister.
But isn't the essence of an organisation like the International Criminal Court, to which we have signed up and are currently members, that it should have independence from the political positions of individual governments, and it should have prosecutorial independence? And all the British government will be doing is simply respecting the prosecutorial independence.
But the objection process does give the UK government a chance of a say in this. That's why Rishi Sunak and the previous Conservative government launched it. You know, Mr. Starmer can't wash his hands of this. You know, there is a way, I believe, to ensure that the UK isn't complicit in these arrest warrants by launching this objection, and also being prepared to leave the ICC if necessary.
What about the argument advanced by some Labour figures, including the Attorney General, that actually this government has to, if you like, correct some of the damage that was done to Britain's international reputation, because they accuse the previous Conservative governments of playing fast and loose with international law, and they're trying to restore Britain's credibility because that will then help Britain be a voice for particular things internationally and be listened to?
The previous Conservative government always complied with its obligations in international law. Yes, there were disputes about how international law applied in particular cases. Every country goes through those kind of things. That excuse from the current government is simply yet another way to try to trash the reputation of its predecessor. It does not absolve them of responsibility. Israel is fighting a vicious enemy that invaded their country, slaughtered 1,200 people, took 200 people hostage.
And there is a warrant also out for the arrest of the leader of Hamas.
And the idea of equivalence is repugnant in these circumstances, to somehow for the ICC to imply there is equivalence between Israel and a vile organisation like Hamas is completely unacceptable. And that is another reason why our government should be fighting these arrest warrants, not sitting back in a way which seems to enable these arrest warrants to go forward. How will it help the peace process?
Teresa Villiers.
The Prime Minister of Israel can't travel internationally.
Teresa Villiers, former Cabinet Minister, thank you very much. Scotland's oldest cello, which, having lain unplayed for 220 years tonight, has been heard in public once again. The instrument, made in Aberdeen in the 1750s, belonged to James Beattie, Professor of Moral Philosophy at Marischal College in Aberdeen. Beattie was a distinguished public figure in his own right, once painted by Sir Joshua Reynolds for defeating the enemies of truth, but he was also a keen amateur musician. Lucia Cappellaro is a cellist with the early music group Scots Baroque, and Dr. Aaron McGregor lectures in music. They're both with us. Welcome to the programme. Lucia, I have to ask you first, what's your verdict as a cellist on this instrument?
It's just stunning. It's very, very unique. It has a very kind of pure, warm and direct sound, which is very unusual. It's beautiful.
And is there any way, in its sense, in which it is different from other cellos?
Very much so. I would say that just in its design, the fact that it hasn't been touched for so long, it's in its original setup with tailpiece, fingerboard, everything. It means that the instrument feels untampered with. It's in its kind of natural state. And that means that everything about it, the way you pull the bow across the strings, everything about the touch under your fingers is completely different. So I basically just spent the last day trying to respond to it and learn it.
Dr. McGregor, tell us something about the owner of this instrument, James Beattie.
James Beattie, he had very humble beginnings. He managed to go to Marischal College, which became the University of Aberdeen, very early as a student, as a teenager.
And forgive me for mispronouncing it.
Oh, not at all. I'm fairly new to Aberdeen, so I was mispronouncing it for some time myself. He then later on became a professor of philosophy and became really one of the key Enlightenment figures in 18th century Scotland. So philosopher, famed poet, musician and writer on music, one of the first writers on aesthetics, and of course a very vocal opponent of slavery. Which is one of the reasons he's so well remembered today.
And that's the reason Joshua Reynolds painted him, yes?
Absolutely, yeah. It was after an essay which was kind of rebuking David Hume on his opinions on people from foreign nations, essentially.
Okay, do we know if he was any good as a musician?
He certainly was a very keen musician. He was a member
That's
of the
very diplomatic answer.
He wrote a lot about music. He, in his letters, he recounts lots of musical evenings he held at his home. And he also was a very keen member of the Aberdeen Musical Society, who held weekly concerts, brought up some of the best Italian musicians, and had the first orchestra in Aberdeen in the 18th century.
Lucia, let me go back to you. What was the reaction of the audience when they heard the cello?
Oh, that's a very good question. You know, I wasn't really paying attention on them. I was concentrating on the cello. No, I think they loved it. And especially some of the pieces that we played by Bocchi, who was an Italian living in Scotland, I think went down very well. They really gave the cello a chance to shine, and it felt like a very fitting piece to play as well.
So, Aaron, no, were you there?
I think they were thrilled.
I was performing as well. Ah. I'm also a violinist in the group. So,
did you have a chance to hear what you thought of it? Just last word.
I mean, I'm blown away by the instruments. You know, the instrument was of interest to me because of its historical importance. You know, it's the oldest Scottish cello and links to James Beattie. But what you don't necessarily expect is it's going to be absolutely beautiful. You know, the theorbo player in our group, Alex, said it's the best cello he's ever heard. Best cellist as well, of course. And it's such an open, warm, beautiful instrument. So that was a shock. Welcome shock.
Yeah.
Lovely to hear both of you, and a lovely note on which to end. Dr. Aaron McGregor and Lucia Cappellaro of the group there, Scotland Baroque. Thank you both very much. Quick reminder, if you want to listen back to any of the programme, or indeed the cello music, you can go to BBC Sounds. We can also download our podcast. The main headline so far on The World Tonight, at exactly 10:30, the former Prime Minister Gordon Brown has called for a commission into end-of-life care, but says he opposes new legislation to legalise assisted dying in England and Wales. Two men who brought around 100 illegal migrants a week into Europe have pleaded guilty to running a people smuggling operation from a car wash in Caerphilly. And a woman who accused the Irish fighter Conor McGregor of rape in a Dublin hotel has been awarded €250,000 in a civil case against him. New York last Saturday night at Madison Square Garden, the Ultimate Fighting Championship promotional company is holding their latest big event with a string of high-profile mixed martial arts bouts, MMA for short. But the biggest draw isn't the fighters. The biggest draw is Donald J. Trump.
45, soon to be 47, President-elect Donald Trump.
MMA commentators reflecting live during the event on the enthusiasm of the fans, many of whom are young men who voted Republican on the 5th of November. Mr. Trump walked into the event alongside the president of the UFC, Dana White, a man with whom he's cultivated a long and fruitful relationship. In fact, right after making his victory speech at Mar-a-Lago on the morning of the 6th of November, it was Dana White who he called to the podium to say a few words. Karim Zidane is a journalist who covers sports and politics. He's written for The Guardian, New York Times, as well as his own media platform, Sports Politica. I asked him to explain why there was such love for Donald Trump among mixed martial arts fans.
The UFC itself began as a countercultural sort of niche violent sport, and it immediately gained sort of an affinity amongst these, you know, countercultural young men. Eventually, this sort of renegade approach to the organization, though it created this brand for the UFC, which was, you know, there are no rules, you know, there are no rules limiting you from, you know, doing whatever damage you want to your opponent. This caught the attention of people like John McCain, himself a boxing fan, mind you. So he was a fan of violent sports, to say, but he viewed mixed martial arts as absolutely barbaric. Eric and disgusting. He called it human cockfighting and basically started all this legislation and lobbying to get it banned across the United States. Eventually, it would get banned across 36 different states. Now, this was really this era of the organization being extremely ostracized. And what happened was, and this is part of the myth that appears thereafter, is that in 2001, the UFC had sold to new owners. And Dana White, the UFC president, was one of these new owners, along with two casino billionaires. Their very first UFC events, UFC 30 and 31, were held at the Trump Taj Mahal. Now, the way the UFC likes to tell this story now is that the Trump basically gave the organization their first shot. These are basically quotes from Dana White himself, because the UFC claimed that they were relegated to these other venues, that they couldn't actually get into really, you know, legitimate casinos and arenas like the Trump Taj Mahal. And that once they started hosting these events for Donald Trump, everything changed for the organization. Dana White eventually would go and speak for Donald Trump at the 2016 Republican National Convention. It was this bombastic speech where he basically said that Donald Trump is a fighter and I know he's going to fight for this country. And the reason he was saying that is because he believed that Donald Trump has this incredible business savvy, that he was able to discover the UFC at a time where everybody hated the sport, and that he can basically do the same for America. And because Trump himself came into politics with this approach of, you know, let's drain the swamp, let's be different to other politicians, it really matched the UFC's own bombastic countercultural approach, which caught the attention of the fan base, which has slowly gone more and more conservative over the past few years. In the decade alone that I've been reporting on this sport, I've watched a massive transformation of the fandom. This was a sport that was once diverse. The UFC itself used to have t-shirts called We Are All Fighters, which they used to promote during Pride Month. They actually promoted LGBTQ plus values. You will not see those shirts in existence anymore.
I was going to ask you, is there a crossover between the demographic profile of the current fan base of mixed martial arts and Donald Trump supporters?
Oh, absolutely. And I think that was really evident in this recent election in November. So what we have here is a UFC fan base now that's primarily made up of young men, but not just any young men. It's either conservative men, or better yet, what the UFC really holds on to is this apathetic, apolitical base.
Arguably also a part of the electorate that has been very difficult for any politician to reach, still less to get to the polls.
This is absolutely true. The thing is that people spend the past couple of years actually making fun of Donald Trump's strategy of targeting young men, this so-called low propensity votership, right? So the truth is that it was an actually incredibly intelligent decision, and it was one that was facilitated by the UFC. Part of Donald Trump's campaign communication staff is a man named Stephen Chung, who actually used to be the UFC's own communications director. The podcast that Donald Trump appeared on, from the Nelk Boys to Theo Vaughn, was also facilitated by the UFC president himself, Dana White. I'll give you one great example. Last year, in 2023, Donald Trump appeared on a UFC's official podcast. It's called UFC Unfiltered. They spent the entire hour just talking about boxing and MMA. Not one mention of politics. Not a single mention of politics. Now, you'd think, how is this beneficial to Trump? Actually, would you look at the comments from that podcast on YouTube and elsewhere on social media, you'll see that he actually resonated with the audience. A lot of people would say, you know, I never cared for his politics, but he might be the only person in DC who I can sit down and have a beer with.
Karim Zidane from Sports Blisco on the links between MMA and MAGA. Donald Trump's pick for Attorney General didn't even make the nomination hearings. The man he wants to be Defence Secretary is fighting off sexual assault allegations. But one nominee is, for now, looking more likely to make it to the Cabinet, Robert F. Kennedy, who is nominated to be Health and Human Services Secretary. Last Friday, we talked on this programme about the potential influence the former British doctor Andrew Wakefield has had on Mr. Kennedy's views about autism. Andrew Wakefield propagated the now discredited claim that vaccination could be responsible. It's not that the would-be Health and Human Services Secretary appears to hold that view, which has pleased some families whose children have autism. It's that Mr. Kennedy seems genuinely interested in finding out more about the causes. Autism spectrum disorder embraces a whole range of behaviours, but even children with less severe symptoms may be non-verbal. Jill Escher, president of the National Council on Severe Autism, a non-profit group based in the United States, spoke to me about the experience of her two children. But first I asked Professor Ginny Russell, a researcher in neurodiversity at the University of Exeter, about the evidence on the number of children who are autistic.
There's definitely been a huge rise in diagnosis, both in the US and in the UK. I mean, we did some work looking at GP registers over about 20 years, and we found an 800% increase in diagnosis of autism.
And just to be clear, that 800% covers the whole range, does it? We're not talking necessarily severe end, right?
That's right. Yeah, the whole range. Most people think that the vast majority of that rise is, it's not because there are more people with autism. It's because there have been shifts in the diagnostic criteria. So there are more clinical resources directed at it, but there are also a lot more cultural resources in terms of it's much more visible on TV. Also, autobiographies, a whole kind of niche of biographies by autistic authors. And there's a lot more research funding and more work directed at the field. So for all those reasons, what autism means has changed historically.
Jill Escher in the United States, can you give us a little bit of your own personal experience? Because both your son and your daughter are autistic and at the most profound end of the spectrum.
Yes, happy to share that. But at first, I just have to say how strenuously I disagree with the assertion that this stupendous increase in autism we're seeing both in the UK and the US is attributable to things like awareness or diagnostic shifts. There's just no evidence for that. But happy to talk about my kids. My son, Jonathan, who's now 25, when he was young, he never developed eye contact. He didn't respond to his name. He would flap his hands. By the time he was two, it was clear something was wrong. So he was diagnosed emphatically with autism by the time he was 2.5. Then my daughter came along 7 years later, and she developed some language when she was a toddler, but it was repetitive language. By the time she was about 18 months, she had a diagnosis of autism as well. And you can't imagine what a shock this was to us, because we had no risk factors at all, nothing like autism in our family trees.
Can I ask a specific question? Because this may be of interest, I think, to people on this side of the Atlantic as well. Did having a diagnosis in any way help you?
No, because there were really no meaningful therapies that changed the trajectory of their disorders. I mean, we did engage in therapies. Did they actually help? I think that's highly questionable. It was glaringly obvious that they had to be in some sort of special ed. They would never have been able to manage in a general ed classroom.
What are you hoping may be different now that Robert Kennedy, as somebody who is interested in autism, is at least nominated to become Donald Trump's health secretary?
Well, it's a good news, bad news situation. So the good news is he is really interested in this dramatic and very obvious increase in autism in the United States. The bad news is that he's been pointing at vaccines, which is an absurd hypothesis. There's no real biological plausibility. And it's really scary to think that we might be seeing reduced vaccination rates.
Professor Ginny Russell in Exeter, do we have any idea of what causes autism?
Mostly it's considered to be largely genetic in origin. It's highly heritable. One of the issues here is that nobody's denying that there could be more children with autism than there used to be. But if you looked at the work that we did, I can only talk about our own study. This was 9 million people in the UK that we looked at from GP's records. We broke down the increase, that 800% that I told you about earlier, and we had a look at the difference between the increase in females and the increase in males. And there was a much, much greater increase in females. And we also looked at the breakdown between children and adults. And there was a huge difference there as well. It was a much, much steeper climb for adults. So what I'm saying is that there is absolutely no reason why females should suddenly be developing autism and males are not. That very clearly indicates that a lot of this rise is due to diagnostic practice.
Just in terms, Professor Russell, of this question, is it possible to be both more understanding, supportive and welcoming of people who have autism and at the same time curious about what is causing it in the hope that we might do something to reduce those numbers in the future?
One of the great founders of the neurodiversity movement was Jim Sinclair. And he was basically saying autism is a way of being. It's not less than. It's equally valuable as other ways of being, but he didn't want to be cured. And for somebody like him, an autistic adult, to constantly be defined by your deficits was something that he felt was actually contributing to stigma and making the problems that he had worse.
Okay, let me bring Jalesha in there.
Well, absolutely, you're right. Who isn't for acceptance? You know, everyone wants that. That's obvious. But at the same time, we have to find out what is causing these massive numbers. I'm really troubled by how Dr. Russell has characterized the data that she has found and the data we see in the UK and in the US. The data is clear. Here in California, where I am sitting, we had 3,000 cases of autism in our developmental services system. That was in 1989. Today, in 2024, this system counts 190,000 such cases. It's not even close. These are really clear, obvious flags that are waving at us, and we ignore them at our peril.
Given research money is limited, where should it be focused?
I think where many parents and neurodiversity advocates agree is that there should be more money prioritizing research on having a good life and not worrying so much about what is causing this, rather actually helping people who are now struggling.
We need it all. We need to figure out what's causing autism so we can finally prevent it. We need to figure out more about these neurodevelopmental pathways so we can better treat it. You know, what's amazing is that the toolbox for treatment today is almost the same as it was 20 years ago. We really have not advanced, and we have a lot more kids now with very severe behaviors, huge needs, who are not getting the treatment they need so that they can thrive or so that they could even be included in society. It's a huge, overwhelming societal issue that we have to address on all fronts.
Jill Escher and Professor Ginny Russell. That's The World Tonight from me, Sean Lay, and all of us here. Good night.